The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here, and I'm very pleased to introduce our author this morning. Unfortunately, I missed her the last couple of times she was here, and the writing in this book is just gorgeous. Diane Ackerman is an award-winning poet and writer about various topics of natural history. She is the author of 24 books, including the critically acclaimed works A Natural History of the Senses, The Moon by Whale Light, and the last book, which she discussed here at the library, The Zookeeper's Wife. In her new memoir, 100 Names for Love, Ackerman recalls her husband Paul West's devastating stroke and the resulting aphasia, which forced her to use her understanding of language and the brain to gradually guide him back to the world of words. Reviewing the book in the New York Times, Abraham Verghese, the physician and author of the bestseller Cutting for Stone, writes, "As in her previous work, Ackerman weds exquisite writing with profound insights." And then he continues, "I will confess I was deeply affected by 100 Names for Love. The book has done what no other has for me in recent years. It has renewed my faith in the redemptive power of love, the need to give and get it unstintingly, to hold nothing back, settle for nothing less, because when flesh and being and even life fall away, love endures. This book is proof." Please welcome Diane Ackerman.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back at the library, a favorite place, and especially to talk about a book that's very close to my heart. We fell in love at Penn State in the early 1970s when I was a flower child undergraduate and Paul was a professor with yards of education, wavy brown hair, and a classy English accent. Somehow, though I was just a sophomore, I'd managed to sign up for his graduate contemporary British literature course. Though I was fascinated by the books and discussions, I rarely said a word since I felt completely out of my depths. But Paul and I talked gamely about literature and life during his office hours, and he responded well to my poetry. For several semesters afterwards, I kept bumping into him on campus or in town. On our first real date, we had drinks at his house, talking nonstop until dawn, and I stayed for 40 years. Some said that we had absolutely nothing in common. Paul and I came from wildly different cultures, generations, and ethnic backgrounds. American culture was the backdrop that I grew up with, but because Paul discovered it as an adult, he never took its oddities for granted. For example, the first time he tried to make Thanksgiving dinner, he just kept boiling the corn on the cob for the longest time because he said he couldn't get the center soft. 18 years older than I, he grew up in an English coal mining village during World War II. He listened to swing music, and he had memories of being bombed. I was a baby boomer, steeped in Beatles-era rock and roll, and my dad had one of the first McDonald's. Paul patrolled the darker recesses of the night, writing in a semi-trance or watching old movies until retreating to slumber at last at 5 or 6 a.m., songbirds migrate at night, and in my imagination, I twinned his restlessness with their lunar flights. I, on the other hand, was completely bewitched by daylight. I woke at dawn and greeted him with a gentle tag, "You're it," hand slap before he climbed into bed. He always waited for me to wake before he went to sleep so that he could kiss me good morning and good night at the same time. He called our relay the changing of the guard and did a fair, if nakedly dangling, imitation of the Queen's soldiers in tall black hats and red jackets. He was, without exception, the most deliciously quirky person I'd ever met, a classic British eccentric of myth and legend, right out of a P.G. Wodehouse novel. He wrote on a clanky old Smith Corona typewriter in a cork-lined study that had no windows. He said that when he was writing fiction, he could make up nature. He didn't need nature. In contrast, my study was all windows. He wouldn't touch or be near fresh fruit, beets, cucumbers, or tomatoes. He rarely left the house. He hated wind, rain, snow, truly any weather if not sunny and mild. He didn't like wearing clothes, and he cheerfully strolled around the house and yard naked. Because society does require clothes, he made a couple of concessions. In the summer, he wore swim shorts and a blue short-sleeved shirt when we went out either to informal or formal events. And in the winter, he wore a velour jogging suit and never, ever socks. At least once, he flew home to England lugging a ream of typing paper, which he sat on to soften it up, he said. I found his eccentricities novel and amusing, in part because I knew that they weren't an affectation, but grew naturally like crystals in the cave of his personality. They sprang unconsciously from a childhood in his English town and a deeply, deeply eccentric family, in which it was typical to pay a call on relatives, only to find aunts, uncles, and cousins all napping naked in the living room with open books covering their privates. The unique society of his brain cells was more than a little different from my own mental colony, but we granted one another most favored nation status. So when asked about the secret to our decades-long duet, I sometimes tease that we only stayed together for the sake of the children. Each was the other's child. And we were both, of course, wordsmiths, cuddle-mad and extremely playful. But who can say why two people become a couple, that small principality of mutual protection and regard? Couples are jigsaw puzzles that hang together in just enough places. They're never total fits or misfits. In time, a pair invents its own commonwealth, complete with anthems, rituals, and lingos. A cult of two, but with fallible gods. Our household was absolutely drenched in wordplay. We confided and bantered. We relished word games of all sorts. We read each other's manuscripts. We devoured books. Every day, Paul invented silly little songs about me, domestic operettas, really, improvised as he walked around the house. I'm not going to actually sing any for you at the moment, but I did include some in the book. He had pet names for me galore, and I did for him, too. We also spoke in baby talk, animal sounds, silly rhymes, sarcastic puns, such as, welcome to the Cirque de Oive, pig Latin, RAF slang, and picturesque nonsense of all sorts. We lived in American society, but truly we lived in the family and culture of words. For 30 years, Paul taught fiction writing and contemporary European and Latin American literature at Penn State. He was infamous for making his students' brains hurt from the strain of learning how to juggle complex ideas. In addition to being a college and county cricket player in his youth and an RAF officer whose job was to lecture on giving good lectures, he garnered several degrees, including a coveted first from Oxford, one of only four given in literature that year. Paul had a draper's touch for the unfolding fabric of a sentence, and he collected unusual words like rare buttons. Then one day, after we'd been together for 34 years, there was a lightning strike. First, he was in the hospital with a kidney infection. Trailing plastic tubes, Paul made his way across the room, steeped in twilight, and I was amazed by how the body sometimes looks like the sea creature it is, a jellyfish with long tentacles, not really a fish at all, but a gelatinous animal full of hidden symmetries, as well as lagoons and sewers and lots of spongy and stringy bits. but mainly salt water. Lugging tubes and cables, he had joined the hospital's bloom of deep-sea creatures. But all that would soon change because he'd been cleared to leave the following morning, though he'd still be taking potent antibiotics. "We escape at dawn," he stage whispered over his shoulder in a British sergeant major voice. The prospect made us both a little giddy. Then Paul went to the bathroom, and when he shuffled out, he stood at the foot of the bed, eyes glazed, his face like fallen mud. His mouth drooped to the right, and he looked asleep with open eyes. And he gaped at me in alarm. "What's wrong?" I asked. He moved his lips a little, making a sound between a buzz and a murmur. For a moment, I had the odd thought he might have a mouthful of bees. Then my spine filled with ice, and I felt as if the floor had dropped 20 stories. A decade before, Paul had had a TIA, a brief stoppage of blood flow to the brain, which ignites stroke-like symptoms that pass. I recognized the bird's speech and the rigid face. "Anything but that," I thought, struggling to comprehend. "Not now. Not again." The tests revealed that Paul had a massive stroke, one tailored to his own private hell. In the cruelest of ironies, for a man whose life revolved around words, he had suffered immense damage, mainly to the key language areas of the brain, and he could no longer process language in any form. Global aphasia, it's called. I'd never heard the expression before, and I didn't want to think about the full cartography of loss. And yet I had no choice, because someone had to make decisions about his care, informed, clear-headed decisions. Where was the tutelary angel who should descend at such times and restore the everydayness of things? I felt acutely unqualified. I hadn't volunteered for this job, and I never would have, given how much was at stake. I didn't want to be responsible for my loved one's life. Sitting in his hospital room while he was enduring more tests floors below, I pictured him in my mind's eye, glowing red with warmth as he was wheeled through the chilly haunts of the hospital. I could track his travels as if I were a pit viper, sensing his heat through tunnels underground. I felt very much alone, scalded by my own ineptitude, and I thought, well, forget angels. Where are all the grown-ups when one really needs one? I knew his plight wasn't unique. Paul was now among the 5 to 6 million stroke survivors, and of those, he joined the ranks of over 1 million Americans living with aphasia, a frustrating, perpetual, tip-of-the-tongue memory nightmare. Aphasia is not the loss of language. It's a retrieval problem, a sorting problem. The words are in there, they crowd one another, and very often the wrong words are the only ones that the mouth can utter. Suddenly, his lifetime of words had vanished. He couldn't speak or read, and he could no longer understand anything anyone said to him. When I crossed the threshold into his hospital room, I entered a world that was unfamiliar with an unfamiliar man lying in it. The man looked like Paul, but he wore a distorted scowl, and he seemed to unhinge his whole body in a vain attempt to speak, reeling upright, flexing his shoulders at odd angles, and flailing his arms against the bed. Then he switched to just a facial tantrum, cheeks, eyelashes, jowls, and nose writhing as he desperately fought to communicate something. "Hi, honey," I said, trying to rally a small smile from somewhere in the coal pits of my belly. Paul fidgeted in a vain attempt to muster all the aggregate parts of his being, but he could only splutter, "Mem." When I didn't respond, bringing down his clenched fist on the bed railing, he repeated it again in loud italics, "Mem, mem, mem, mem." "Easy now, easy, quiet, it's okay," I said, in what I hoped was a calming voice. Paul would tell me years later that right after the stroke, he felt different than before, newly embedded in himself, as if he were trapped in statuary. His room seemed to be full of Hopi dancers and dazzling as Mardi Gras, almost festive. He felt his teeth blink. Something pagan was going on with a mad ring to it, like a disturbed vibraphone. People were speaking a foreign language, maybe Quechua, and they didn't seem aware of the pandemonium light show he was enduring. That kind of Alice in Wonderland sensory warping is very common after a stroke as the damaged brain struggles to make sense of its surroundings. "Hi," I said softly. He struggled to respond. Then he spat a little sound. He kept wrestling, and the more words eluded him, the more frustrated he became, until his temper boiled, his face flushed, his jaw opened and closed in silent damnation, and his eyes darted around the room. At last, he glared at me with pupils tiny and hard as BBs. Suddenly, he clenched his fists and thrashed his arms as he shouted, "Mem, mem, 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 mem." Fixated on the idea of home, Paul soon began trying to escape. With the hospital gown flapping open in the back, face tufted and bloody from clumsy attempts to shave, his hair a short cyclone, he waited until the coast seemed clear. Then he took wing down the hallway, shambling and weaving at speed, subversively heading for the exit, without knowing exactly where that might be. Once, like a deluded Magellan, he circumnavigated the floor, almost making it to the elevators before a nurse and an aide captured him and led him trumpeting angrily back to bed. Several days later, despite his lack of coordination, he managed to wiggle out of his hospital gown without setting off the alarm, put his loafers on the wrong feet, and abscond naked down the hallway, sliding along the wall as if he were installing wallpaper. Noncompliant was the term that the nurses grumbled about Paul, the rebellious patient in room 252, the running man. Paul lived in the hospital's rehabilitation unit for many weeks, relearning the everyday feats of daily life that we take for granted. How to swallow food, sit in a chair, steer a spoon to the mouth, comb his hair, use the toilet, walk upright. Arduous work with physical therapists brought back some balance and dexterity. And then a few words returned to Paul helter-skelter, including one usually slurred as a plea and often as a demand, home. In time, Paul left the hospital for what has been a 6-year odyssey of relearning language on his part and caregiving on mine. At some point in all of our lives, every one of us will be a caregiver, not necessarily of a spouse. It may be of a parent or a grandparent, a sibling or a child. Or we will be cared for by loved ones. If you live long enough, that's simply what happens. The challenge is to try to find a way to do that with grace, ingenuity, laughter, patience, and love. Stroke changes everyone in a family. A caregiver especially is changed by the culture of illness, just as we're changed by the dynamic era in which we live. For one thing, I don't have as much free time and conversation with myself, and I feel the loss. And I certainly worry more about his death and mine too, since I'm so much a part of his daily health saga. It's not all gloomy, though. Caregiving offers many fringe benefits, including the sheer sensory delight of nourishing and grooming, sharing and playing. There's something uniquely fulfilling about being a lodestar, feeling so deeply needed. And it's fun finding creative ways to gladden a loved one's life. But caregiving does buttonhole you. You're stitched in one place. Nonetheless, I find that I've grown stronger in every aspect of my life, in large ways and in small ways. Among them, that I've discovered that I can handle adversity and loss and yet keep going. I have a much better idea of my strengths. Coming to terms with being responsible for someone else's life took a long while, and at times I even felt like I might be breaking down. Overwhelmed, I feared that I was either going to have to give up my career and just take care of Paul, or feel like a total monster and have my career but not take care of Paul. My challenge was to see beyond either or and find a way to be a loving caregiver of Paul while also nourishing myself. At first, I managed only by compartmentalizing my own life, his life, work life, play life. And then finally, I learned to embrace it as a whole. And now, on most days, for the most part, I'm just living my life. When I first learned that Representative Gabrielle Giffords had been shot in the left temple, I felt a fierce pang for her and her family, because I knew only too well what damage to that part of the brain can usher in. Paul had damage in the same area. Both Paul and Giffords had unwillingly joined a very large, ill-fated club, people of all ages with traumatic brain injuries. For about 300,000 people every year, the injury is due to a traffic accident or a gunshot wound. Add to that the number of all the young soldiers. The Pentagon says 200,000 since the year 2000, but outside sources put the figure at closer to 400,000 who've suffered brain injuries in war, many returning home with aphasia, needing speech therapy and rehabilitation, often much more than their insurance will cover. Paul went through 5 noble-hearted speech therapists, all using the same standard workbooks and methods without helping him improve very much. He would dutifully join his speech therapist in the library for an hour each day, emerging exhausted and demoralized, having punished his brain in an effort to fill in blanks, list words within categories. How many flowers can you name? None. How many animals can you name? None. Link words with pictures and attempt to perform other language skills. Despite their simplicity, he found the exercises completely demoralizing, sometimes impossible. Can bowls swim? A workbook question asked. I knew the answer they wanted was no. But bowls could float, even heavy bowls, if they were flat and large enough. The large, flat-bottomed bowl of an ocean liner, say. If Paul thought like that, too, then he'd give the wrong answer. They meant small, inanimate household bowls, not the bowl of the deep ocean, say, holding currents, coral, plants, and creatures. Can water freeze? That one was easy. But some of the questions required only the literal meaning of a word, not the way that it's used every day in slang. Can bullets grow? Certain kinds of exploding bullets expand or grow on impact. Can pearls fly if someone throws them? Can beavers talk? Those in the Ipana toothpaste commercials of the 1950s used to sing. Is a siren loud? Air raid sirens, yes. The seductive bird ladies of Greek mythology who lured sailors to their deaths, not necessarily. Can stones burn? And how? The stones on a sun-baked beach, or the stones encircling a campfire? Can bags frown? They often do, especially if the groceries are packed unevenly. Are parakeets tame? Store-bought, yes, but wild parakeets nest on several continents. Paul loved the squabbling, squawking monk parakeets that nest in Florida palm trees. Choosing the correct answer could be as tough as herding cats. Even if he understood all the words, and I wasn't sure that he did, he was still too imaginative for this sort of one-size-fits-all exercise, which requires a different habit of mind. One day I was walking through our little library at home when a speech therapist was showing Paul a photograph of a telephone on a table. She pointed to the table and said, "What's this?" And he said, "Skylargle." And she said, "No, that's a nonsense word. It's a table, a table." "What's this?" And she pointed to the telephone. And he said, "Tesseract." And she said, "No, that's also a nonsense word." And at that moment, something dawned on me and the trajectory of our lives changed. I walked back in and said, "You know, oddly enough, a tesseract is a real word. It's a three-dimensional object unfolded into the fourth dimension. And in a funny way, that's what a telephone does." And it began to dawn on me that Yes, maybe the words that we learn when we're very small, sky, mother, milk, chair, table, maybe they are processed mainly in the key language areas of the brain, but it's possible that words that we learn as grown-ups, maybe in specialties or in hobbies, are handled more like a foreign language. And I realized that I had heard Paul saying big words, none of the little ones, but every now and again he would spit out a large word. And as I soon found, he had quite a store of vocabulary intact of those words that people might not recognize every day. But at that point, I took over his speech therapy myself, and I started tailoring it to his individual background. Just keep his language mill churning, I thought. That's the key. So one way or another, from waking until bedtime, I tried to keep Paul drenched in words. I talked to him throughout the day, slowly, in short sentences, even if he didn't understand. I encouraged him to talk, giving him yards of time to respond. I hired a very cute young nursing student as a home health aide, a self-described chatterbox, and asked her to swim with him each day, talking continuously. Oh, and to wear her bikini. I thought that it might inspire him to pay attention. I discovered in Paul's therapy how important it is for a patient to tell his or her story, just in order to make sense of their life again and to find a way, if possible, to re-inhabit it. After a couple of months, when he was lamenting that he was not going to be writing anymore, I suggested that he dictate, albeit with agonizing slowness and frustration, his memories of being in the hospital. I encouraged him to watch television, especially movies, and I created silly, personalized, fill-in-the-blanks, Mad Lib sort of homework for him. When he lamented that he could no longer remember any of his old pet names for me, I encouraged him to make up some new ones, one a day, using the colorful combinations that his aphasia produced instead of fighting it. And so he did for 100 days. And some of my favorites are Spy Elf of the Morning Hallelujahs, My Little Bucket of Hair, Dream Hobbit, Little Moon Skipper of the Tumbleweed Factory, O Parakeet of the Lissom Star, My Billiard Table of the Decaying Gods. I thought that was pretty strange for a pet name. Anyway, there were 100 of them. And there's a YouTube video in which you will also find them, and I list them at the back of the book. And I just love them. As far as I was concerned, they were a good way to help him learn to make images again, which he seemed to have lost the ability to do. He seemed to have lost some of his synesthesia during the stroke. Because of my brain studies for An Alchemy of Mind, I knew the new golden rule of brain research that, contrary to what we all learned growing up, brains are not rigid and unchangeable. They're plastic, as neuroscientists like to say. In a nutshell, this means don't give up hope. Unused neurons or neurons used for other purposes can often take over the functions of neurons that have been damaged. I knew, though, that this was going to mean long, hard work for both Paul and me, a real marathon effort. But keeping the wonder of neuroplasticity in mind allowed me to have hope, faith in the learning process, and motivation to keep going. It's now been 6 years since that stroke, and thanks to hard work, love, and the brain's gift for rewiring itself, he has relumed vibrant carpets of vocabulary. He's written 3 books since then. Paul and I can finally talk with each other again, sometimes with relative fluency, others in really roundabout ways or by playing 20 questions. Sometimes it's like code breaking, others smooth sailing. Aphasia still plagues him with its merry dances, and with its occasionally missed adverbs and verbs, its automatically repeated words and phrases. He can't use a computer, can no longer type, sometimes has trouble reading his own handwriting, so he'll always need a literary assistant. During his window of heightened fluency in the middle of the day, right after he wakes up, He can write or string words together in chains to make telephone calls or talk with friends. He can't do all three. He has to choose. Is he going to write, make phone calls, or lunch with friends? We often remember, though, with a shiver, those early days in the hospital when life felt small as a noose, and I really thought that it was the end of our long love story. I discovered instead that it was only the beginning of quite a fascinating new chapter. We no longer worry about his getting better. We no longer regard aphasia as a process of recovery with stages, but rather as a chronic illness like diabetes. Our life is different, but sweet, often devolving into hilarious charades as he tries to pin a word down, like a lepidopterist holding a handful of oysters. Such hilarious things can tumble from an aphasic's mouth. For example, one morning while I was working in my study, I heard the low whisking rumble of the bedroom door opening, followed by footsteps, and soon Paul appeared at my study door, naked as a wombat. "Where's my cantilever of light?" he asked sleepily. I smiled. This was a new one. "Do you mean your velour jogging suit?" I asked. "Yes, it's in the laundry room." Why did his brain produce cantilever of light when it was searching for velour jogging suit? How or why or when might it seem to him a cantilever of light? Cantilevers are rigid, his jogging suit soft. Cantilevers support bridges. Unless he was thinking of his clothes as a bridge to the bright, wide-awake world, that really seemed a stretch. But the phrase captivated us, and we had to laugh when we realized that we'd been together for so long that I just instinctively knew that cantilever of light meant velour jogging suit. I also liked the time when I just mentioned in passing, "I'm feeling so sleepy today. I wonder why I'm so sleepy." And he said, maybe your brain has been requisitioned by a higher force," by which he meant I was paying too much attention to looking after him. Talking with someone who's aphasic, you live in a state of perpetually realizing and of enjoying the aha moment of insight that comes with solving a verbal puzzle. Paul's stroke has changed him, but not all for the bad, and it has also changed me. But isn't that always the secret to a long marriage? It's not really one marriage, but several. People change, events change them, and their life as a couple evolves. To stay together, to thrive, one has to embrace the changes. Surprisingly, the stroke has brought Paul a new caliber of happiness, one that's based much less on striving and more on the sheer joy of being alive and being loved on a crazy blue planet in space. We unwrap one day at a time, treating it as a star-spangled gift. And so our duet continues to evolve, and even if we can't go back to the land of how it was, we're designing a good life for us in spite of everything. Oddly enough, when Paul is gone, I will probably look back on these days as some of the happiest in my life, despite all of the worries, frights, and impediments, because I've loved heartily and felt loved in return. The pet names continue to flow and flower. Some are funny, some romantic, some playfully outlandish. A recent favorite of mine is Smooch Owl. They're all a testament to how a brain can repair itself and how a duet between two lovers can endure hardship. A bell with a crack in it may not ring as clearly, but it can ring as sweetly. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'd be delighted to take questions if you have any, and I think there are two people here with microphones. Right over here? Yeah.
Have any of the speech therapists or any of the professionals caught on to what you've done and adopted those kinds of procedures?
Did you all hear in the back? Yeah, good. They have. In various places, there are speech therapists who do exactly that. They find out what their client what their client's history is and what the person's life was beforehand, and try to bring into the sessions things that would have been of interest as a way in, maybe partly because it will be more motivation. Well, let me give you an example. Recently, Paul was working with a speech therapist, not for aphasia, but for a muscular thing, the side of the mouth. And she was absolutely brilliant, but it occurred to her that maybe she knew him so well at that point that she just understood him more easily than other people would. And so she asked him to explain the rules of cricket to her, because he had been a cricket player. And boy, did he get excited about that. And he just launched right in, you know. So I think that they do use those, but for whatever reason, we didn't encounter that. And as I say, we went through five different people. It's much easier when you're teaching anything, if you're teaching in high school or at college or speech therapy or whatever, to go according to a lesson plan and a workbook. But the other way of teaching, figuring out how each student needs to learn, is more effective. Right back there, yeah.
I got a question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What you got, hand, this.
His signaling with his hands and pantomiming?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He did a lot of pantomiming at first, and there's something called restraint therapy, where if you, for example, have injured one arm, they restrain your good arm, and they force you to use the bad arm. Well, he was doing a lot of that normally, but there's also a version of that with language, where as much as somebody wants to pantomime, you don't let them. And I found it very hard to do that, and so we did do pantomimes and so on. And I tried to think of them as a parlor game, like charades, rather than as something that had been imposed on me as, you know, an affliction. Here I have to interpret. It's so much, at least I found, a question of how you can reframe something, which is not to say that I didn't find it brutally hard to communicate with him early on, and sometimes now, because he will sundown, as a lot of people do. But the real challenge, as I was saying, was finding a way to keep our playfulness and laughter and romance going despite everything. So one of the things that I did, since we couldn't talk to each other, is that I started crawling in bed with him every morning, and we would just cuddle for about 45 minutes. And speaking with aphasia is similar to speaking. If you have a stutter, if you've seen the King's Speech, remember the more stress that he was under, the harder it was for him to speak. And so it's much harder if you have pressure on you. And by the way, I think it was very brave of you to raise your hand and be speaking. It's a lot of pressure to do that, a lot of stress. But, you know, first thing in the morning, when you're not really awake yet and you're kind of canoodling and stuff, it was easier for him, and I did a lot of quiet language work right there and then with him. And we would find ways to play and still have fun with words. Yes?
You spoke about the importance of telling one's own story.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, when someone has aphasia and perhaps might find different words than what someone who's listening could understand, the kind of frustration that could pile up in not being able to tell the story in a way that the person who's hearing it really understands. And I'm just curious how that gets spanned.
Okay, did you hear back there? Yes, all the way back? Great. I'll just keep testing to make sure. There's no question, with my arty background, I'm much more at home with unusually poetic turns of phrase and so on. So I found what he was saying hilarious and very often picturesque in a way that I'd have to really work hard to achieve. And somehow his brain was just throwing out these beautiful combinations of words. Yes, it was frustrating. And it was especially frustrating for him to be trying to tell his story, of course. And I found at first that when I suggested that he might like to try writing the first aphasic novel or something like that, and I was just thinking it would be good therapy for him, but he thought that was a good idea, I found that he couldn't coordinate everything. He couldn't get his brain to find the word and tell the hand what to do. And so I thought, I'll just remove some of the elements and have him dictate. And that required very gentle questioning. One of the first things I asked him was, when you had the stroke, did you continue to have that voice in your head? You know, that monologue that we all have with ourselves from birth to death, because I was curious. And he got very excited and said, yes, three. And I said, three. He said, yes. I said, three. He said, yes. I said, who were they? And we just kept teasing it out little by little. So, yes, the person who's working with him has to be very patient. It's very interactive. Sometimes I would have to wait. I could almost see his brain running a little maze, you know, getting blocked off, looking for one word, not finding it, bumping into a wall, going someplace else for the next word that almost would capture it, and so on. It could take a very long time. But it was enormously rewarding for him. I did some of the dictation. The nursing student, Liz, did some. Another home health aide did some. And he really got into the spirit of it. Later on, it was important to him because at the time of the stroke, his brain wasn't making memories. Of course, my brain was too traumatized to want to remember things. Neither one of us was really remembering much. And so it was only years after that I sat down to write the book. And at that point, he came to me each day and asked if I would read him what I wrote that day. And as he learned better what had happened to him, but also what had happened to me and what I was going through, it brought us much closer together. Yeah. Let's try here and then up here.
Hi. I wonder if in all these therapeutic attempts with professionals, if anyone tried to get you and your husband involved with any assistive technology devices to assist with communication or, you know, either verbal or writing.
Paul tried some. He tried a kind of a typewriter computer thing, which didn't really work for him. In the beginning, as is typical, he had a quadrant missing off to the right side. And whenever he would look at lines on a page, he would see lines jump over each other and do other kinds of tricks. So he had a lot of trouble with handwriting and with technology. But one of the most interesting things, I think, and one of the reasons that one shouldn't really believe any doctors or textbooks that tell you that there is only a window of opportunity in which you have to get whatever improvement you're going to, and after that, forget it, is that for years afterwards, Paul made small but really important gains and improvements, and he has continued to. Recently, he learned how to handle his checkbook for the first time. It's been so important to him to do that. Something else I noticed, though, is that I saw him looking at two pieces of manuscript, same page. One, though, was corrected for the aphasic places, marked in red, by Liz. And I saw him sitting there looking from one page to the other page and back again, looking fully over to the right and back, making corrections, not having to hold his place or anything. This is not something that he could do before. But clearly, from just doing it over and over and over, he had retrained his brain on how to do it.
When Paul came up with these delightful images, such as the cantilever of light for the velour jogging suit, would he reuse that same sequence of words to describe it? Was it then that becomes the name, or was it a different name every time?
Different name every time.
And the other question was, did he comprehend what you were saying? He just couldn't articulate what he was trying to say.
Yes, in time he could understand what I was saying. For the most part, I had to be careful not to switch what I was talking about too many times in a sentence. And at first, it was better if he just spoke with one person at a time. Recently, he's been at a table with a couple of us talking rapid fire back and forth without any problem, but that's taken some years. And remember I said Liz self-described chatterbox and the two of us can kind of go at it. So he's gotten used to that over the years. But he could understand. It's just that when he went, he even knew the words he wanted. He had them in his head. He just couldn't get them to his mouth. Instead, something else would come out. In some cases, he would keep saying the wrong thing. There was an ice cream treat that he liked called Slim Bears, and he, for whatever reason, could never, ever, ever remember Slim Bears. But he did remember that there was this paradox of something very small and a big animal. And so he would ask for it as tiny elephant, you know, or something like that. Yeah. How about right here?
Had you any sense that you had this capacity for patience?
Oh, no, I had no idea that I could be as patient as I have had to be, and I was not patient all the time. It's not that I didn't fall down a lot. I think the success was in being able to stand up again, not in not falling down, because I certainly did that a lot. How can you not? I have so much respect and compassion for caregivers now that I understand that it's a full-time job. I don't think any of my readers knew that I was writing The Zookeeper's Wife after this had happened, and that it really was part of my salvation to be able to lose myself in that world of that woman in World War II who was a serious caregiver, much more than I could ever be, and who was looking after 300 people and making sure that they survived the war with their humanity intact. For me, I just as I was saying that to you, I was getting chills. It still touches me, her story, and it was very helpful to find something that I could lose myself in. And it was a kind of form of transcendence or meditation, and I think meditation is very helpful in that too. But, you know, there's a big difference between being mad at a spouse because they're acting out of bad character and being upset because a spouse is acting in a way that they have no control over. It's not really their fault. You could still be impatient. You could be resentful. You could be angry. You could want to escape. You could feel all kinds of things. But there's just a difference. You know, if it's not malevolent, I don't know. I found that there was just a different attitude that I had. And also, since we don't have kids, I think that part of all that mothering, I just focused on him. Right, all the way back here.
All the way back where? Okay.
You said when you first approached him in the hospital, he was banging the bed, and was his behavior like that before he had the stroke?
Was his temper, did you say?
Yeah.
Yes, his personality changed with the stroke, as very often happens, not always for the better. But in his case, it did. He had a what he used to refer to as an Irish temper. It was very volatile. And after the stroke, that part of his brain quieted down. He also lost his emotional response to music, which had been a lifelong thing. His mother taught piano to every child in the little village in which he grew up. And for all the time I had known him, he could not get through a day without having classical music playing constantly. After the stroke, no interest in music at all. And this other thing where the rage seemed to be gone. And I wonder if they're not related in some way. I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If you had just, before the stroke, if either of you had dreams and would talk about dreams with each other in the morning or sometime during the day, does he relate to you his dreams now?
No, Paul was someone who never remembered his dreams. He dreamt during the day while he was writing. That's my explanation for it. And so when he, on the very odd occasion that he would remember a dream, it would be really boring. Really boring. I went out and got my laundry. I did something like that, you know. The outrageous, hallucinogenic dream stuff he dreamt up during his work. Yeah. I think we have time for one more. Yeah.
I hope this is good then. you had said that he no longer had an emotional reaction to music. Hello. Could he recall how he used to feel about music? And now, and then after the stroke, would not be able to experience that emotion again? Or is it just all gone, like an etch-a-sketch?
Well, that's a very good question and a tricky one, because even if you haven't had a stroke, the nature of memory is that it's only true to the moment of recall. You revise your memory every time you remember something. And they've done all kinds of really interesting studies with people who have viewed important public events together and in later years and what they remembered and so on. And we just keep revising the memory. So the simple answer is yes and no. He knew and believed that he used to listen to music all the time. He would know that if only because there was like geological strata of CDs and tapes around his office. But that piece was just missing. He just didn't need it any longer. If I play classical music for him now, and if it's beautiful, he'll appreciate it. He'll say it's beautiful. He'll have an intellectual response to it. But he won't require it in order to get through the day, and he won't use it as an emotional bookmark the way that authors and other artists very often use music, so that they can get back into the frame of mind where they left the work of art. And that's why they keep playing over and over and over, I don't know, Howard Hanson's first symphony, the Aliens theme, you know, that beautiful music. Sometimes, in Paul's case, he might play a Copland piece over and over and over. And I've done that myself, and it's to get instantly, take the shortcut back to where I left the book. But he doesn't do that anymore. The whole process is very different. Well, thank you very, very much. And I hope you'll come up and say hello. I'll see you upstairs. I know there are books there as well.
Thanks to Diane, and also to you for coming. And Mary Detweiler is out in the vestibule there if you want to take a look at some of the literature from the local National Aphasia Association. She has various things out there for you to look at. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.